Okay, the basis of this state is that people consciously have certain philosophies, but yet the way they act or the way they express themselves in different ways shows that there is another philosophy operating beneath the surface or in the unconscious. The first one that I ever heard was from Rabbi Chaith, and he mentioned jealousy. And he said that jealousy, the philosophy of jealousy, is that I choose who should own or who should have different things. I hold you shouldn't have this, I should have it. You see? Now, once I hold that you shouldn't have it and I have it, and I should have it, so then my philosophy is that I should decide who owns things and who doesn't own things. And the thing is that that's, of course, taking away. I mean, the conscious philosophy is the philosophy that we accept that God designates who should have what and who shouldn't have. And so, therefore, this person is taking away God's job, and he says that I should have it and not the other person. So he decides who should own things and who shouldn't. Wow. Alright, the next one is that the, is you'll notice that people, do things at, certain times. Like they say, the morning is better. Morning is the best time for me. Or certain seasons are better. Okay? Now definitely, the way you should feel good or bad is basically, in other words, if I make $1 million, I should be glad. You know what I mean? If I lose $1 million, then I feel bad. But when the season or the time of day makes you feel good or bad, that's not in line with reality. That's not a realistic thing, you see? So the philosophy is, it is true that sometimes that it is a physical thing, something physically actually affects you, like for instance bad weather, it gets very chilly and you feel physically, it affects you physically. So but you wouldn't say the time of day, it is when it's cold. I'm not saying, in other words, certain times there is physically something that really affects you. However, there are many times when it's just that you hold that the time of day is somehow works better for you, you see, or that the seasons work better. The question is, why would that be? Okay, the question is that in psychology some students learn that certain people, their brain cells work differently in the morning or in the evening, or at different times, their brain cells work differently. Now, this whole idea of brain cells, of when they work or when they don't work, the question is, does the brain cell cause your emotions to work, or does your emotions affect your brain cells? That they haven't proven. They just assume that it's that since it works physically, that's the cause. But maybe the way your brain cell works is a result of the size of your psychological makeup. Therefore, it's your effective. So if I do not see any proof from the physical world that it really affects me, then I have to assume it's a psychological thing. Okay? Let me get this. I'm not saying that every time there is a... there is changes in your brain cell or there are physical changes, that it is always psychological. I'm saying you have to prove that I have not seen any scientific, anyway, I've not heard of any, and I'm not that familiar with all of them, where they've taken in the psychological situation and maybe that affected the brain cells. Okay? I'm not saying that all psychological affects the brain cells. It could be there might be other things. There might be chemical reactions. There might be other factors. I understand. But they don't take in consideration the psychological at all. Now, all I'm saying is that I don't see any physical reason why a person should think better by day or by night. There's no physical reason. And there's no physical reason why you should learn better in the spring than in the winter or whatever. You understand? Different times of years. Different times of the year.
But there are.
So the thing is, but it's not, there's no proof that any of these things affect your thinking. I don't see any reason. So we see anyway that people make decisions about different times that, or different places that that seem to work better for them, even though there doesn't seem to be a physical cause. So therefore, their philosophy is that there are certain places that are, or certain times which are lucky. In other words, they're affected by the time. In other words, it has like a magical power. Like somehow the time or place that affects them has a magical power and affects their situation for better or for worse. Now, sometimes you will find that these unconscious philosophies in certain situations become real philosophies. Okay? When Yeshua, after they lost the battle of Ai, and then they repented of their sins, and so they repented, they lost the battle of Ai, and it was because they sinned, so they repented. The next day the plan was to go out at the exact same time as the day before. Why? Because they knew these people were into magic and superstition, and they realized that these people hold that if they won the battle yesterday at that time, that becomes a lucky time. So therefore, if they go out at that time, they feel more secure, and they'd be able, Yeshua, therefore, once they feel secure, they do things that are not correct, not protected. And once they do that, so then Yeshua would be able to win the war. It was a whole strategy, and that was part of the strategy. So you see, but anyway, you see from there that the unconscious emotions, the unconscious philosophy, has sometimes becomes a reality, and it becomes a conscious philosophy of different people and of groups of people. The next one is that you notice people that hurt other people, sometimes they hurt people either verbally or physically, and then they ask for forgiveness, they say, "I'm sorry," and they ask for forgiveness, right? But however, there was absolutely no change in the person. In other words, the person could do it again, then again ask for forgiveness. Or sometimes you'll notice that people ask for forgiveness before they do the act. Says, "I'm really sorry I have to tell you this, but," you understand? So they give the excuse beforehand, okay? The philosophy of these people, the philosophy of these people are that the that verbal excuse removes the removes any sin or anything evil that I have done. If I just give a verbal, without any change of action or anything, just a verbal, excuse, the verbal feeling sorry, expression of sorriness, removes any type of guilt that they might have. Now, this also happens to have, in the world of religion, that you do find this as a real philosophy, and that is confession. Confession in Christianity is you could do any sin, there's absolutely no change in your personality, there's no change in, you haven't changed anything, all you have to do is verbally confess your sins. In fact, I did hear that some people confess their sins beforehand so that if they should die while they're sinning, so they already got their confession in, so that they shouldn't they should go to heaven and not to hell. But anyway, but you see that is a real philosophy. Now, it also works that in Christianity is you turn to an authority, namely God, to forgive you. And therefore, you are turning to the person that you harmed also becomes that you turn to that person to forgive you, and you assume automatically that that person will forgive you. In fact, you will find the person doesn't forgive you, then you'll get upset and angry with the person. In other words, you blame the person. The person should have forgiven you. So therefore, the thing is that you need some person to forgive you for what you have done wrong. That's the unconscious philosophy of expressing sorrow without any change in your actions or personality. In other words, you need people, you need some outside source to justify that what you did is okay as long as you ask for forgiveness. You need that justification. If you don't have the outside justification, so then it's not good. If you don't have that outside justification, so then you feel it doesn't work. So that's why you get upset. There is no question that when the person says, "I'm sorry," he really means he's really sorry. At that moment, he really feels sorry. But the sorriness is only a result of guilt. As soon as you forgive him and the guilt passes, then he can go back to his old ways again. It's not a change in personality. You understand? There is no change in personality. He feels it sincere. He really says, "I'm sorry." And he really feels it. But that feeling, the cause of that feeling of feeling sorry, is not a result of knowing a reality that he's changed his view of reality and he realizes he did something wrong. It's just a result of guilt. That means there is no change in his view of life. And therefore, there is really no repentance at that moment. No real repentance, as we understand it. It's only a result of their guilt. So therefore, there is absolutely no change in their personality. So therefore, they all know, if I get excused from you, then I'm okay. That's their philosophy. So just my verbal expression, that's good enough for you to forgive me. Once you forgive me, that removes my guilt. I'd like to clarify about the philosophy of ordinary people. You know, everybody has a philosophy, but they don't. The difference between a philosopher and a person is the philosopher tries to clarify what his philosophy is, while a regular person doesn't think about it, but he lives based on a certain framework. And also the difference is that the common person, his philosophy is based on his feelings and his emotions. So therefore, his philosophy started not based on his thoughts. It can't, you know, it happens to him. While a philosopher tries to work out the correct philosophy despite the fact of his emotions. Okay? I'd like to clarify this idea in stealing and a robbery and how it works. Okay, there is the philosophy of the mafia, who hold that whatever is mine is mine, and whatever is yours is mine. Why? Because I have the right to. In other words, if you try to steal from me, I'll kill you. And if you don't let me steal from you, I'll also kill you. So what's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine. Okay? That's the philosopher. That's the philosophy of the mafia. On the other extreme, there are people that will never take anything of anybody else's, absolutely nothing. And absolutely nothing they will not take, and they do not rob. A lot of people think that is the correct philosophy. We'll soon see. That's an extreme also. Okay? And there are two components of the emotions. One is the animalistic part, and one is the conscience. So you see, the extreme in the animalistic part is the philosophy of the mafia when it comes to stealing and robbery. And And the other extreme is that I don't take anything of anybody else's at all. Okay? Now, between these two philosophies, there's also a combination of the ordinary person that he has, where he's not the extreme of the mafia, and he's not the other extreme either. What he does is he says you're not allowed to steal, but he will steal like small items. And the reason why, what permits him to do that is because he can bypass his guilt or his fear of getting caught. You see? So if he takes a stamp in a place that he works, he says, well, you know, either I'm not going to get caught or they don't really care. So by saying they don't really care, I remove my guilt, or by have a fear of getting caught, so I say, nobody's going to, I just put a stamp on it, you know what I mean? They're not going to bother with it. So there's no way of getting caught. Those are the three philosophies of the of stealing. But there is another one, and that is halacha. For instance, in halacha, Halacha is there's a psak, a decision by halacha that if you take away something from a student and you feel it's necessary for his training to destroy it, you have the right to destroy it. Okay? How do we know that? What's the decision? What's the proof of the decision? He says because in the Beis HaMikdash, the young Kohanim that would first come into work, they used to guard the Beis HaMikdash at night, like an honor guard. They used to guard the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the Gemara says that if they would hear screaming in the middle of the night, they knew that one of the students fell asleep, and somebody caught him, and they set his clothes on fire. So you see that was the method of training. Now you'll notice that the other three people will have a problem with halacha. Well, the mafia will have a problem with our idea of justice. Forget it; they won't accept that. But the other two will not accept this idea of discipline. We have the right to take away something of yours and smash it to discipline you and to train you that you should continue, you know what I mean? They would never accept that. It's too open, you know what I mean? Like it's against society. The middle one is more in line with society. The middle philosophy is more in line with society. It would be against society, and the extreme conscience definitely would not hold from such a thing. So you see that the training of halacha is that you have to make distinctions to know when taking something from somebody else is stealing and when you have the right to do that. In regard to the punishment that we gave the Kohen in regard to the that fell asleep, or a student that's listening to a tape recorder with the music on during class and you smash it, there is a Gemara that says that the time of Chizkiah, the king, the students were 9 years old, knew all the laws of purity, which is one of the most abstract of all the six parts of the Talmud. You understand? And the reason why is because they had guards with drawn swords standing outside of every school. Okay? Nobody played hooky. Nobody walked around the bushes to smoke a cigarette, believe me. You know what I mean? Nobody did anything. Nobody was on pot or any problems that we have in the public schools we would never have if we had armed guards there to make sure that they studied. Now the question is, would you rather have a society of trained thinkers, or would you rather have, kids that are totally free and do whatever they want because they know they could get away with it. And by the way, definitely the pressure from society is just as great. They put up grades to a very high degree, and where the grades become more important than class, you see, everybody just works for the grade, and a lot of kids cheat because the only important thing becomes the grade, and they are under pressure to study too. So what would it be better, to destroy something physical to get them the pressure to study, or to give them a wrong attitude toward study altogether to get them to study? If it's in the hands of a person that doesn't know how to use it, then you're absolutely right. I think terrible things could happen, and instead of having learning, a love of learning, you will turn people away. But however, in the hands of a very just person and knows exactly the correct situation to do it, when to do it and when not to do it, I think it can be a very just thing. Just like grades in the hands of teachers that don't know what a grade means, that it's only to help them learn, or parents that build the grade beyond the subject, you see, it can destroy the student. So can this system, in the hands of anybody, could be destroy the people, could destroy the students. So I say the system of not physical, I'm not talking about physical punishment, I'm talking about property. I'm only talking about property. I say that in the hands of a person that has the knowledge of when to do it and when not to do it, and not to do it out of anger, I say that method would be a very good method, and better than the grade method. What Matthew said is that the grades become like a mindset, and it affects your mind. But however, in so far as just, in other words, it becomes a total mindset which sets your mind and a certain personality and a certain way of operating. But breaking a physical object will not affect the way they think. It will not affect the way they think if used correctly. Just to go back and summarize what we said there's different philosophies that people have without really being aware of their philosophy. Like the mafia really holds the philosophy of whatever is mine, and what's yours is mine. The other extreme holds, I can never take anything, touch anything of anybody's for any reason. Then there's the middle, where a person really holds from the mafia, but he has certain guilt that doesn't allow him, so he can only do it in situations where his guilt or fear of getting caught, he can bypass those fears or guilt. But however, the rational way of approaching this is to know when, yes, to make distinctions when you should and when you should not. I'd also like to discuss Lashon Hara, gossip. Okay? In Lashon Hara, the philosophy of a person that speaks Lashon Hara would be what? When I say what his philosophy is, I mean when he does that act represents a certain philosophy. The act represents. He doesn't think of it, but we want to define that act, what that act is, you see, what the philosophy of that act is, but he wouldn't know consciously what it is. What we're talking about now is a person that speaks Lashon Hara or gossip. And the philosophy of the person is that somebody else's privacy is not private, but my privacy is private. In other words, if I talk about other people, so I say they don't have any privacy, right? They don't deserve privacy. Right? But however, if somebody talks about me, I'll say, how dare they? Well, they don't even have all the facts and they're talking about me, right? But however, you don't think about it when you're talking Lashon Hara. So it is that they have the philosophy that you do not deserve you do not deserve privacy, but I'm the only one that deserves privacy. The question is that I mean, people are not that deep. They would not think in terms of the way we defined it. They would not. People do not think that way. And when they're doing it, they're only feeling a need to express information about others, but they don't think this way. And I agree 100%. But what we're trying to do to clarify, to make clear what we do in our everyday life, many times we don't realize it. If you put the act in terms of a philosophy, so then the idea becomes clearer what you're really accomplishing and what you're doing. You see? Just putting it in terms of the philosophy makes it clear of what you're really doing, what you really hold. Most people say, oh, no, I don't hold that. You know what I mean? If you really told them. They would say that. But the truth is their act defines that they hold this philosophy, even though they don't realize that they hold this philosophy. I say for the person that sees that defines the philosophy of Lashon Hara and recognizes how unjust they really are, what they really hold, I think this is a step. I don't know, in certain people it might be able to undo it. But however, for certain people they might have to take further steps, but at least they realize how unjust and how hypocritical and contradictory they are, that they, if they're honest, most people will not listen to you. I mean, if you tell them that, they'll just get angry with you. But a person that's interested in correcting themselves, when they see this, it becomes very clear to the mind. When you define it in terms, their actions in terms of philosophy, then they totally clearly see what they're doing. And therefore, they would want to deal with it and to start correcting it. The question is that how come, in other words, it's similar to the mafia idea. The mafia holds what's mine is mine and what's yours is mine. Here I hold my privacy is private, but your privacy is not. On the contrary, you don't even deserve privacy. So the thing is, it seems to be the same as the mafia mindset, and yet they don't feel guilty about it. But most people would feel guilty about joining the mafia, but yet about talking Lashon Hara, they will not feel guilty. The answer is that Lashon Hara is character assassination, okay? And therefore, character assassination is it comes from the same desire to destroy somebody. You see, I don't think it's any different than killing him or character assassination. Okay? In fact, it could be that killing him is less painful than they have to live with a bad reputation. Okay? But the thing is that there's a tremendous amount of guilt attached to killing a person, but there is no guilt attached to this. Guilt by murder, or by taking something away, you could see the person harmed, and you recognize in the physical world that he's harmed. But this is too abstract, and most people could bypass their guilt by talking Lashon Hara, because they don't see the harm. They assume the person won't even hear about it. They're not afraid of getting caught, because the person won't hear that they said it. Most of the times you don't. They might even not hear about it. They don't even realize that their character is being assassinated. You see? So therefore, I could bypass the guilt and the fear of getting caught, because it's not like murder. You see, it's not equal to that physical murder. And secondly, since it's abstract to define that they're being hurt, that most people don't think that abstract. That even though it's not really very abstract, but most people don't even go that abstract to feel guilt about it. You see what I mean? As a result of this philosophy of the mafia, of the mafia, and even the other extremes, all the emotional extremes, and also in Lashon Hara, there's going to be a certain consequence that comes about. And I'd like to read to you from Proverbs chapter 10, verse 12. And it says like this. It says, hatred awakens quarrels, and all sins are hidden by love. In other words, when you're in love, you can't see the faults of others. And when you are angry, you could only you can't see anything good about them. You could only see faults. Okay? Now the thing is that definitely when you have these philosophies close off certain possibilities. You see? It closes off the other possibility. Like the Mafia would never consider any of the other three philosophies. He wouldn't even consider it. He can't even grasp the idea. He can't talk to them about it. Whether right or wrong, he can't even accept the possibility. You see? And Lashon Hara is definitely the source of Lashon Hara is anger and hatred, right? And it closes off any possibility of good qualities. You don't see any good qualities when you don't like somebody. When you talk Lashon Hara, the whole purpose is only to see the wrong qualities, and you cannot see the good qualities. So as a result of that, you have to close your mind from making distinctions. And therefore, it's a training of the mind not to be able to distinguish and to subdivide different areas. And since you cannot do that, it definitely has to affect your life because you're not thinking correctly. And you won't see all the possibilities in when you investigate. Whenever you do an investigation or think about something, if your mind is closed, the emotions close off certain possibilities, so then you lose out on your investigation. So therefore, these type of emotions will definitely close off the possibility of making distinctions and will affect your thinking process. And it will also affect affect your decision making in everyday life, which will be short-circuited. In other words, because you can only make a decision only in a very narrow area, and not to see the whole broad spectrum of all the possibilities that you could do. And the question is what about when you investigate yourself? Okay, the thing is that definitely. When you start this investigation, most people love themselves. And because of that, they're definitely blinded to certain aspects about themselves. And therefore, that definitely is true. And you will lose out on possibilities. But the investigation, if you study the area of Musa and study these through the ideas of the Rishonim and our sages, you will find that the... You'll start training your mind. You'll start seeing things that you didn't see before. And as you take step by step, you will be able to see yourself for what you are. But it's a long trip. It's a long trip, and you definitely have to overcome this blindness in yourself. It's absolutely true. It's definitely there, too. And in the investigation of the self, you must overcome this, you see. That's why a doctor cannot, his family shouldn't be a patient there, because he's blinded, you see. But to yourself, I mean, you have to be blinded, and yet that's what we demand, that you, who you're blinded most to, namely yourself, that you must undo that blindness to be able to see yourself for what you are, for good or for bad, you know, for better or for worse, whatever it is. You must be able to be that honest to be able to see yourself in every aspect. The question is, can you do this investigation by yourself? The answer is that some people can. But some people can, and some people need the help of others because they can't do it on their own. So it depends on your situation. And you have to be extremely honest in that area if you can do it on your own, or if you need somebody else to help you. We're not discussing that when you define somebody's philosophy, what you should do about it. We're only discussing the ability to be honest about things that people do not want to be honest about and that they hide in their unconscious. And we want to be... The whole subject is the training to be honest. Not what you should do about the information. Even your information about yourself, what you should do about it, that's a further development. But the first step is just to be honest, to know who you are, and to know who others are, and to define them as best that you can based on actions, and if you know more than the actions, like about yourself or if somebody tells you information, just to define what the person is. And there are many ways of defining. We're only talking about defining in terms of philosophy. You can define in terms of psychology. You can define in terms of good and evil. There are many ways of defining. We are just defining in terms of philosophy the nature of people to help us to be honest about others and about ourselves. The question is, what is the first steps to get to this idea of philosophy? And the answer is that you have to observe, you have to be able to observe actions of people and put that and separate it in terms of philosophy. In other words, when you do something, there must be a philosophy. It has to be defined in terms of philosophy, even if you didn't think about it, like we did with the mafia. We defined their philosophy. We defined the philosophy of Lashon Hara. There are certain actions that a person does that you could define. The first step is to be observant about people, not to put any value system and not to put any value about them. It's not a value about good or bad. Just what, according to their action, what is their philosophy? If you would, I'll give another example, extreme example. Let's say a parent, when a child goes in the middle of the street, they reprimand him. But when they just whack the floor and the child drags mud in it, then the parent hits him. Now the question is, that's just ordinary life, right? The question is, what is the philosophy of that mother? The philosophy of that mother is that messing up my kitchen is worse than getting yourself killed in the street. Now if you point that out to the mother, they would say, oh no, that's impossible. But that act is telling you a value system. Now I'm saying in every act of everyday life, I'm saying that you could define the philosophy of the people, the way they act, the way they deal with others, and I think their philosophy can be defined. Just a matter of training. In other words, what we're doing here is people act in a certain way. Based on the way they act, we are saying what their philosophy is. A philosopher would not probably, I've never seen a philosopher that does this, what we're doing. But what the philosopher does is he tries to analyze the physical world and tries to discover what reality is. What philosophers do is when they have other philosophies, they try to show contradictions in it to show why they don't accept it. You see? But that's not what we're doing. You see, the regular philosopher usually when we talk about philosopher, is that he is searching for what is the correct value of life. What is the purpose of life? How should a person live his life? What's his purpose in life? What I'm saying, and when they investigate, they see different philosophies and they show you the contradiction. I am saying that when you do an act, not every act, but most acts represent a certain philosophy of life that you're not thinking about, and if you define it, you're able to put in front of you clearly your own stupidities, so that you, first of all, many of that could just clear up. Once you see it, you say, yeah, it's stupid, and you straighten it out. Sometimes that is not enough to straighten it out, but at least you know what is necessary to do afterwards. Another case that we have is this is a story I heard that seems to be true. They said it was true anyway, that a guy came to rob a store, and he was walking out. While he was walking out, the storekeeper called the police, and he told the police that he was robbed. And he started describing the suspect. And the suspect, while he's there, he heard him speaking, he started correcting him on the description to give a better description. He started correcting him. And, of course, while he was correcting him, the police came and caught him. So the question is, what is this guy's philosophy? We want to say that he identifies with his personal description. In other words, he identifies with the way he looks, that becomes the most important thing, and when he's involved in that area, everything around him is forgotten, because that's more important than the practical that surrounds him, his identity, which is his image of himself is based on the superficial view of the way he looks is more important to him than anything around him, even the fact of getting caught. We're talking about height, facial features, you know, these type of things that you would describe a person. He kept correcting it. People without thinking would call this guy nuts, you see. Now, what we're trying to show with this defining of philosophy, that's what we're trying to show, that once you define the philosophy of a person, so then you see the stupidity. But where your emotions are involved, that's where the stupidity comes out. And you could really see it, without going very deep, you could really see it in one or two ways. Sometimes you could formulate a contradiction. The contradiction helps you see it. Or what we're doing is formulating his philosophy based on his actions, which show clearly the emotion that is dominating at that time, and which emotion is more powerful than the reality at hand. In other words, when you call a person crazy, it is his personal emotion, his personal needs at that moment, which overpower him and that doesn't allow him to deal with the reality at hand. That is the definition of crazy. So therefore, when you define these definitions, that's what you see, that their philosophy is, it clearly shows that their philosophy is not in line with the reality. Somebody mentioned that there's a possibility that he wants to get caught, you see? Therefore, he states, that might be true, but from the facts, what he was correcting, based on the fact that what he was correcting the storekeeper in, you understand? I'm basing on his words, based on his words of the storekeeper, you understand? So therefore, I'm just sticking to his words, and that's what I'm basing his philosophy on. So therefore, it could be that he wanted to get caught, could be. But the words tell me that his philosophy is what we said it was. Okay? Okay, there was this father that his son was a bike racer, you know, a motorbike, the dirt bike, you know, racer. And his father helped him in his career and bought him whatever he needed, outfit and bikes, the best, whatever he needed, the father helped him. But, however, after the race, if his son lost the race, the father would totally tear into him and break him down, and even to the extent of hitting him. Okay? So the question is, what is the philosophy of the father? I say that his philosophy is that my needs are greater than you or your needs. That's basically what his philosophy is. Philosophically, in other words, when you say that he identifies with him, that's a psychological view. But his philosophy is that my needs are greater than you or your needs. The philosophy just explains the act. The act is my needs are greater than yours. And if you do not fulfill those needs, then you deserve punishment. Because you're not fulfilling my needs. My needs are the correct needs. Your needs are not. So therefore, if you do not carry it out, therefore you get punishment because you're not living by my philosophy. So therefore, you're not living by the true philosophy. So therefore, you deserve punishment. You see? That is what, but then of course you could explain it psychologically. That's a different aspect of the situation. Okay? In other words, sometimes it's just enough to give the philosophy to, which forces you to see the contradiction or the stupidity of your act. And sometimes that, if it's a superficial thing, that could be enough to straighten you out. But if that's not enough, then you have to get into the psychology to understand what causes it to undo it. So the psychology tells you the cause of the philosophy, but the philosophy points out the stupidity of the act. There's a story about Aristotle Onassis that he was on an island that was captured by the Turks. This was part of Greece, and he was captured, and it was captured by the Turks, so he wanted to pay off, so he paid off the officials to get off the island, to get away, and to get his father and himself off. And when his father found out how much he paid, his father told him, that's too much. Okay? So the thing is, his philosophy is that money is more valuable than his life. Okay? So he says, just from the fact that we have, there is another possibility. And that is that when the Turks asked him, I guess he offered a certain amount of money, the Turks accepted it. His father is saying that in reality, you could have offered less and they would have accepted it. Not that money is more valuable than life, but the reality of this situation is that you pay too much. His understanding of what the Turks would take would be much less. So he's reprimanding him on recognizing reality and how to evaluate. So therefore, there are two possible interpretations. One would be enlightening of the mind. That's definitely in others. Secondly, then it's possible to see in a lot of cases your own philosophy and see the contradiction. It might cure it, it might not cure it, then you might have to go further, but at least you're able to see the problem. It also helps you in another way, even if you don't investigate yourself. It also helps you see that without a real philosophy, without really being thought through what the correct philosophy in life is, then by definition you go by human nature, just living by your basic human nature, you will be living a incorrect, foolish, and sometimes act downright stupid philosophy, as we see from the various cases that we already have. And I think that also is an important point. The question is, there's the famous story of the boy that cried wolf. He went up into the woods. He used to take care of sheep. And when he cried wolf, everybody comes to protect their sheep, but you just watch the sheep. So after a while, when he cried wolf, the townspeople didn't come. And then when the wolf really came, they didn't trust him anymore. So then the wolf really ate the sheep. Okay? So the question is, so we know the moral of the story. I mean, it's pretty in there. But however, we want to know the philosophy of that boy about crying wolf. What's the philosophy of the boy? The question is, why did he cry wolf? The answer is, why did he cry wolf to begin with? The answer is that he made a joke. It was for a joke on the people, on the townspeople, to just a joke. Right. Well, they would run out of their house just for nothing, and that would be a big joke. Basically, we're asking the question, what's the philosophy of a person that teases others, you know, laughs at other people's expense, okay? We're saying that it seems to be included in this would be a practical joker, okay? So we want to know the philosophy of that. I don't know, this is not his philosophy, but one step you could take is that his enjoyment is where other people are fools, or they look foolish, right? In other words, he enjoys making people look foolish. I sense that the answer doesn't lie in power. I sense that the answer lies in the enjoyment of making people look foolish. I think that's what a tease is, It's not a power. It's not a power thing. I don't think. I think it's a like a more of a sadistic type of enjoyment. You see what I mean? I don't think it's a power deal. You see? I think it's more a sadistic type of thing. But that's again, that's not his philosophy. That'd be explaining him psychologically. Okay. It comes out like this: that my pleasure of the of this person, this kid that teases others, is my pleasure. My pleasure is greater than the conflicts of others, or the harming, or the inconvenience of others. Okay? In other words, I think in general the sadist, the philosophy of the sadist, is that my pleasure is either my pleasure is at the expense of people, or my pleasure is the hurting of people. And sometimes practical jokes, they want to say is like you want to get even with somebody. We're not talking about practical joke as used as a tool for vengeance. We're talking about the practical joke that we're talking about a practical joke for the sake of the practical joke. That was the story of the boy who cried wolf. Is that it doesn't show anything that he wanted to hurt them because of vengeance. It was just for the practical joke, which means that he holds that his pleasure is the enjoyment and has priority over people. That is his pleasure, his enjoyment, is of hurting people. In other words, in psychology, we would define the source of how it comes. We might want to know background about the person. In philosophy, we just want to define the act in and of itself. What does the act say? You see, that's how you get to the philosophy, by just looking at the facts of the act and not trying to find out what caused him to act that way, but just to define what the act is saying. In other words, what I'd like to say is that the same object could be put in different frameworks. Like a human being could be put in chemistry. What's his chemical makeup? You see? Well, you can look at man biologically, then he's in the same category as a whale. He's a mammal. Or you could put him in terms of philosophy. How he's different than everything, any other animal, is that he has a mind. He's in the same category as animal, but he's different in the fact that he has a mind. Same thing here. You could look at the first. You have to see to show that that you're doing something wrong. That's two ways. One is through contradiction, or what we're doing now to show the philosophy. Just define the act. What's his philosophy? So you see you're able to see the contradiction clearer. Then you might want to analyze it from a totally different aspect, namely the consequences. In fact, the story of the boy that cried wolf was the purpose of just to show the consequences, you see? That would be like Mishlei. The purpose of Mishlei is to show the consequences. Then you might want to see it psychologically, what causes him to do different acts. So the same act could be looked at from different angles. Depends what angle you're studying at the time. What we're trying to do now is to define the philosophy of different actions and what they are, and to be able to define it in terms of philosophy, and that really would be a first step, so that you could see that there's something wrong. Then you want to see the consequences, and then you want to see psychologically what caused you to do it altogether, so that you could be able to cure yourself. Sometimes the first step could help you. Sometimes the second step. Sometimes you need the third step. Whatever it is, someplace along the line, you could be helped through this knowledge. Okay? We're working on a first step of defining just the act by itself, not explaining it. Just what is his philosophy? We're going back to the boy that cried wolf. We want to redefine the philosophy of the boy, that people are only objects to his pleasure. That's his philosophy. You see, his philosophy is that people are only objects for his pleasure. That's it. In other words, he doesn't see them as an equal, that I have to understand that we're a community, we have to work together. I just see them as objects for my needs, and my needs is to make fun of these objects. So I only recognize them as objects, but not as equals. I look down on them, right? So I only look at them as an object to put down. The question is, what is fashionably late? What's the philosophy of fashionably late? The first possibility that we want to say is people want others to look at them. You see, so if you're walking late, so people turn to look at them.
They notice you. They notice you.
You want to be noticed. I see. You want to be noticed. Right. So we want to say that that if you come too early, then nobody's there. Okay, you're very few people, so you feel uncomfortable. If you come very late, that's a splash. So it depends if you're splashy. Okay? And then there's in between where you're fashionably late, where people notice that you come when you come in. Another possibility is if you come too early, it looks like you're too eager to come. Like you don't have what to do, or you're too excited. That you can't show that excitement in society, that you're so excited. So you come fashionably late, that you want to come, but you're not so eager. You're very late. That's like looks bad. People look down. I mean, why you come so late? You know what I mean? Like people say, what do you want to make a splash? Hey, the question is, why is it that we feel that if we are eager, that's wrong to show, okay? But however, we should be like cool, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not eager, and I cover my emotions to show that I'm not eager. That's the question. In other words, we're discussing like Clint Eastwood in his movie doesn't show any emotions. And he just acts out like cool. And we want to know what is the philosophy of that type of person that feels there's a certain weakness and vulnerability with showing emotions. Question is, what is that philosophy? To be cool, you have to act that there's nothing driving you, but yet you don't need to control it. There's nothing that you have to control. You don't have to control. You just cool. You know what I mean? Like, not emotion. You know what I mean? You just do without being driven. That's the way it seems like. Like, you're not driven. Nothing bothers you. You see, that's cool. You see? That's the description of cool. You see? Now, we want to know what's the philosophy of being cool. In other words, the contradiction is that ultimately he's denying all his emotions. Some people deny some of their emotions, like, you know what I mean? But here, cool means is like, nothing bothers me, I'm not driven, I'm okay, the way I am, I'm cool. You see? And nothing bothers me, see, I'm cool. You see? It's really a contradiction. I mean, no, that's not human. You know what I mean? So the question is, well, what's the philosophy of such a person? Really, the ultimate person, let's say, for instance, like an Einstein. Einstein really didn't care about how people looked at him. He really didn't care. It didn't bother him. He wore long hair. His clothing was a little baggy. You know what I mean? He wasn't, you know what I mean? He looked unkempt. He just didn't care about people. He was totally involved. What he did care about was his studies. He's involved in studies, but he did not care about what the public thinks about him. And the public senses, see, they don't know, but the public senses that is the correct way of going. You see, they sense that. So, but since they don't know what it is or how to do it, so then they act that way as if it doesn't bother them, right? You see? That's why people are cool.
because they sense the great person really doesn't care about the public. You see all great people, like the guy, what was his name, Wright, who built buildings. He built it the way he felt, and even though people didn't want to give him jobs and things like that, he didn't care. He did what he wanted. All great people do not follow society. That's the way to become great, because they live by what they think is right. Whether right or wrong doesn't matter, but they live by what they think is right. Now, those are the ones that are respected. So what the public does is they take a superficial part of it. They act as if nothing bothers them, so that they're really cool. You see what I mean? So that's the idea. Okay, we still have to formulate the philosophy. A very good example is where people do not want to accept thank yous. They say, "Oh no, you don't have to thank me." But you know really that they do want to be thanked. You see? But the tzaddik just does, let's say for instance the tzaddik, he does things because of justice. So he really doesn't have to be thanked. His purpose for doing it is just that, nothing to do with people. But people want to be like the tzaddik, so they say, "You don't have to thank me." But that statement of "you don't have to thank me" is really trying to act like the tzaddik when you're really not the tzaddik. The question is that there seems to be people that don't operate this way. That is correct. There are many people that don't think cool is the right way, and they show their emotions. Okay, we're only talking about a person. We're only defining or clarifying the idea of a person that feels it's important to be cool. Okay? That's all we're defining. You're saying there are people that are not this way? You're absolutely right. There are people that are not this way. They have different philosophies. What we want to know is what's the philosophy of the person that has to act cool. We just explained why he acts cool, but we didn't explain what his philosophy is. In other words, he wants to show that he is an independent person. But however, the fact that he has to do this, he has to show this, shows that he's not an independent person. That's the very thing that shows that he's not an independent person, like the real great people. Well, putting it another way, the tzaddik is subservient to truth and reality and to justice, while the other person is subservient to society and what society thinks about him. One possibility is that he is great. He is great. He says, "I am great if I have the superficial qualities of a great person." You see, where he where I do not. In other words, where just like the great person does not care. So if I act like the superficially like the great person, so then I am the great person. The question is, let's say, for instance, would this guy act emotionally in his room privately where nobody sees him? Because since if it's only for the public, then he should be able to do it, you see? And if it's not for the public, so then he'll do it all the time. The answer is my personality might be based on the public, but I really believe it. Because of the public, I really believe it. It's not an act. I really believe that I am great when I act according to certain acts that I define as being great. Yet you don't realize that step. That step is unconscious. But you act like the great. I know there are people that try to act like a chacham. And it's a good, by the way, a good incorrect motive, because it drives you to do the correct thing. But you'll act like a chacham in every single place, and you really believe that you're a chacham at that time. You see, and therefore you cannot act differently in the privacy of your home, because we're dealing with unconscious drives. So therefore, since it's unconscious drives, you could do it any place, even though the real motive is for the public, or the motive is maybe to fake yourself out, to think that you're great. That could be. But the fact is that you can't say In other words, if I would say I'm only doing this for the public, if he would realize that consciously, it would lose his whole drive. That would lose his whole drive for acting that way, because he said, because then he'll realize that I am not cool. He tries to make himself believe that he is cool. You see? And he really holds that coolness is greatness. You see? But what we define as philosophy, he takes a superficial quality of greatness and makes that the great thing. You see what I mean? That is the philosophy of the person that is cool. In other words, the thing is, there are people that are certain situations that the situation demands that they have to act cool. Like, for instance, a person that's leading an army, he has to act cool, even though he's upset for the troops. He has to do it. We're not talking about such a person. We're not talking about a person that's trained to be cool on the job, even though he's really emotionally upset, like an airplane pilot. Something terrible happens. He can't act on his emotions then. He has to control his emotions. That is a practical thing. We're not talking about. We're talking about a person that comes fashionably late to show that it doesn't bother him. Person that says, you don't have to thank me, you know, it's okay, it doesn't, I just do it, you know what I mean? Like, it's just a natural thing. We're talking about that type of person. We're not talking where it's practical that you must control your emotions to be able to operate in a very difficult situation. That is a rational thing to do. We're talking about a person that acts based on the feeling that I should be cool. You see, I'm cool. Nothing bothers me. That idea of I'm cool, his philosophy is, if I take the superficial quality of somebody that really is great, then I am great. In other words, he sees that the great person, he senses, not consciously, he senses that a great person does whatever he wants to do, despite the fact that the society doesn't accept him. In other words, Einstein, you understand, he was a great person. These people did things differently than society, and they were accepted as great people. So he doesn't look at the work that they put in, that they were interested in their work, and they were involved in their work, and in their involvement in their work and their attachment to their work, they didn't care about society. That's a result that they don't care because they're involved with their work. So I'm not defining this precisely. I don't know if this is precise. But however it goes, something like that. They're involved in their work, and they only care about their work. They don't care about what people say. Okay? But the thing is that what the other people pick up on, they don't see this. They only pick up that this guy does things that everybody's against him and everybody thinks he's great. So he sees that part. He only sees that part that he picks up. So he attaches to that part and says, that is the greatness by acting cool. So if I act cool, I am great. But he doesn't do it. He doesn't sense, that's unconscious, that the fact that other people, that he's doing it for other people, you understand, or that he really believes that this is greatness. And that's an unconscious thing. You understand? He doesn't notice that. He's operating by a part of him that's hidden. All that comes out is that he acts cool. That he has to act cool as if it doesn't bother him what people think. You see? That is what's happening here. You see? So therefore, his philosophy is that I will, if I take the superficial quality of the great person, then I am great. The next question is a person that in other words, their self-worth is totally and entirely by other people. They're totally self-conscious and always aware of themselves, of how, in other words, always thinking about how people are thinking of them. Did I do something wrong? Did I do the right thing? It's always dependent on other people, their self-worth. So we want to know the philosophy of such a person. The question is that there are certain societies that somebody mentioned that it's Confucian society that it's dependent on what the society operates is dependent on what other people will say.
Yeah.
But that philosophy is not a philosophy of reality. Is that correct? It's not a realistic philosophy.
It's not realistic,
so therefore, that philosophy is based on a certain emotion, right?
Normal.
So no, it's not normal. I don't care what, but in reality, it's not normal. Okay, so we're discussing a person. I don't care if it's a society or an individual that operates on that, on their self-worth, is totally based on other people. I'd like to know what their philosophy is. That's the question. A description of a bad self-image is where other people's values are more important than mine. Okay? And therefore, even where I don't know what they're thinking, then I become very insecure because everything is based on what other people are thinking. My own security is based on what they're thinking. So we want to say that his philosophy is that reality is defined by other people. That's what it is. He defines reality, what he's doing, whether it's right or wrong. That reality, whether what he does is right or wrong, is defined by other people. That's the way he defines his reality. Or right and wrong. He defines right and wrong by other people. The question is, how do you define reality realistically? Okay, that's the question. I mean, if this is not reality, so the question is, how do you define reality realistically? I think the best way of looking at it is through the consequences. You understand? If you look at it through consequences of your actions, so that becomes reality. In other words, like this. If there's certain acts that will destroy society, it might be nothing now, but in the future it'll destroy society. What is an act now that's nothing wrong now, but it'll destroy me in the future? You see what I mean? So then you have to analyze what are the consequences. That's one way of looking at reality.
I'm basing it on consequences.
If I'm talking about the society, then of course the consequence of society is not how society thinks, but there are consequences of living a certain type of life. If you live a democratic life, right? If you have a democracy, then the government is run by fools. And therefore, there must be consequences because the fools vote in the people. You see what I mean? And they tell you who's going to be a leader. And they choose their leaders by all these philosophies that we've been defining. So therefore, when they get those people that are going to run the government, that way you're going to have consequences. You see what I mean? It's not the way people think. In reality, there are certain consequences of acting incorrectly. So you must, the first step would be to learn the consequences. In other words, when you have an incorrect view of life and you act upon that view, you will have consequences. In other words, a society is made up of people,
right,
and people are made up of different emotions, various emotions. Okay? Now, when the group has a certain philosophy, it must be based on some human emotion, because the philosophy is coming from humans, even on the society.
Okay.
Now, I'm saying, just like in the individual, when he sees, when he lives an incorrect philosophy, he must get the consequences. So is the person, so is the society that has an incorrect philosophy must get the consequences of that philosophy. The case is like this. The case is that a kid does only partially a chore that he's supposed to do and refuses to do the rest of the chore at all, okay? He refuses to do the chore. Only under strong pressure do they finish the chore. In other words, they're supposed to do an act that they're responsible for. And they're refusing to do an act which they are responsible for. Should make no difference what their age is. I mean, we're working on two possibilities. One possibility is rebellion, and one possibility is laziness. But however, we're looking for it philosophically. We want to look for it philosophically. But we're saying that it can't be an age difference. The age shouldn't make a difference. We're going to take rebelliousness first, okay? The first possibility is that you're pushing me too far, and this is as far as I go, right? The question is when he did the first half, did he want to do the first half, or was the first half some type of a compromise? In other words, he does half, he or she does half, and then doesn't do the whole thing. That's what I'm saying. Well, I'm taking responsibility here, not to here. I mean, what's the problem there? Or the job is done, or the job is done poorly, right? So the thing is that that is not saying that I'm only going to work till here. There's something more in the person's philosophy. Their philosophy is, the rebellious philosophy is that you don't have, I know. The philosophy of the rebellious person is that because you tell me, I don't want to do it. Okay? That's the philosophy. But, however, they recognize you have the power. They recognize you have the power. So they have to do something, so they do it partially, or they complete the job in an incorrect manner. You see? So therefore, the philosophy starts with, the philosophy of the rebellious person starts with that because you tell me, therefore I'm not going to do it. Okay? But where I sense that I can't fight the authority and I have to give in, so I give in a way that I still have an outlet for my rebellion, that I'm not going to do it the way you want me to do it. You see? So the first thing, if I don't do it at all, then I'm not going to do it because you said I should do it. Then if I do it partially, so then I said, then my philosophy is I'm not going to do it in the way you want me to do it. That's the two levels of that philosophy. The question is that the possibility was like an independent person that they were questioning, that it could be that it's like an independent person that doesn't want anybody to tell them what to do. In other words, that I am standing up for my rights as an independent person. But an independent person would recognize responsibility and recognize their responsibility. An independent person you could talk to, you see? And you could explain that this is your responsibility, and then they do it because they understand that it's their responsibility. But a rebellious person refuses to do it because you said to do it. Their philosophy is, if you tell me to do something, that's the reason why I won't do it. Even if I want to do it, once you tell me, I'm not going to do it. That is a possibility that's not rebellion, and they don't do it because of laziness. Okay? Laziness is slightly different. It has nothing to do with you. It has to do with the authority, you see. Laziness is that I do not want to take any responsibility. I refuse to take responsibility for anything. Like, I think, like on Shabbos, I don't think it's very difficult to keep Shabbos. It's really not difficult. I think the idea that I am restricted is difficult. The idea that I can't do it is a problem. But the idea that you can't do it, I mean, the fact that you can't do most of the things you could do any other day. Most of the times, there's very little that's really so complicated that you can't work out. You understand? But however, most of the times it's the idea of restriction. See, a lazy person does not want to take responsibility or be restricted. You see? I would say there are two different possibilities of laziness. One is don't restrict me. You understand? I don't want restrictions. And the other possibility is that I don't want to take on responsibility. Well, restriction is responsibility. It's really the same thing. I'm sorry. It's really the same thing. When you're responsible to do something, that immediately restricts you. You see? And when you're restricted, that's a responsibility. They're both two sides of the same coin. They're two sides of the same coin. I don't think it's two separate things. I think laziness is that, which aspect is the essence? That might change in people. I mean, or the situation. But the fact is both are there. The responsibility, in other words, I refuse to be restricted or take responsibility for anything. That is the lazy person. The rebellious person doesn't do it. He's not lazy, but he doesn't do it because he refuses to accept authority. His philosophy is that I'm not going to do it because you tell me, you see? But the lazy person simply doesn't want responsibility, or he doesn't want restrictions on himself. So that's a different type of different philosophy. The question is, let's say somebody thinks it's not worth the work to do a certain thing. He doesn't care about the... In other words, the results is not worth the work. Now the question is if that's in line with reality. Because sometimes in reality there are things which you say which really isn't worth it. Which the work is not worth the results. Is not worth the effort. That has to be a real evaluation. So if it's a real evaluation, so that's a realistic philosophy. That would be realistic. But if he fakes himself out where it really is something that he would really want, but he fakes himself out that he says, I really don't want, it's not worth it, and he's really faking himself out, then it must be either the rebellious philosophy of I'm not going to do it because you told me to. The only thing is he rationalizes that it's not worth it, or he doesn't want to take on the responsibility, and therefore he's saying it's not worth the result. On the last point, that maybe it's not an emotional mistake, but it's an incorrect view of the fact. The only way that could be is if he's ignorant of certain information.
Right, right.
If he's ignorant of certain information, then it is possible, and there is no... In other words, if it's worth finding out whether you should do it, then you should do the investigation. So that also could be a problem. But however, if he does the investigation, to no fault of his own, he wasn't able to get facts, and then he made an incorrect decision based on that, that is not his fault. Look at the consequences of his actions. But however, it is no fault of his own. Then it's not an incorrect philosophy, but it's just an error. Yeah, then it's just not his fault. The question is, which is easier to work with, the rebellious person or the lazy person? I think it's easy to work with the lazy person because at least he's willing to listen. But the rebellious person, by definition, he can't accept anything you say. That's his whole philosophy, that because you said it, I'm not going to accept it. So therefore, it's much harder to deal with the rebellious person. I might want to say that that if it's the extreme case, then the lazy person is too lazy to do it, and the rebellious person won't listen. So he says there's really not much difference. He says, but if it's not the extreme case, above rebellion and not the extreme case given equal, says at least the rebellious person, once he hears it, could do it. The lazy person, even if he understands it, might not be able to do it. So it says it could be that the rebellious person is easier. But insofar as that happens to be true, it's possible that it's true, but however, insofar as the idea of rebellion and the idea of laziness, it's easier to get to laziness than to rebellion. It is true, maybe practical. Sometimes a rebellious person, if you do reach him, he'll accomplish more than the lazy person because the lazy person has to work with the laziness. But the thing is that insofar as the nature of rebellion, and the nature of laziness. If we're talking about the nature of rebellion is worse, because the nature of rebellion is that he doesn't listen. Yeah, so the thing is that therefore I say that it's still, insofar as laziness is concerned, laziness is the easier one. But it is true, if you win over an energetic, rebellious person, you can accomplish much more than a lazy person. That happens to be true. Okay, the question is, we're going to deal with the philosophy of a cynic. What's the philosophy of a cynic? The question that we want to know before we could define it is a cynic only about people? Like whenever a person wants to do something, they always look at that, it's how it's selfish. Like he's doing it for politics. He's doing it for what he could get out of it. He never could see anything good in a person. Is that a cynic? Or is a cynic, he cannot see anything good in life? Like life doesn't seem to be good, and you know what I mean? And people want to make a distinction between a cynic and a pessimist. Okay, a cynic is about people and their actions. When they do an act, then the cynic always looks at the act as if there's something sinister about it, and never anything self-serving. Okay, something self-serving, and the pessimist looks at life as nothing is of any value. Okay. So we have two different philosophies. The cynic, in other words, what they're saying is that the term cynic has a different description than the term pessimist. If you say they're both the same, then pessimism is like the psychological, it's more a psychological term. But if you describe pessimism differently than cynic, then it's two different types of people that we could describe. The cynic looks at when anybody does something or says something, it's really self-serving. And the pessimist looks at life that nothing is of any value at all. That's their understanding of cynic and pessimist. And for the discussion, we're going to accept that a cynic is with people, that he can't take, when anybody says something, it's always self-serving. And we're going to accept that the term pessimist describes a person that looks at life as there is no value and there is no benefit in, like the glass is half full, right? He always looks at the bad part of life, can't see anything good in life. Okay, so let's take the, we're going to try a cynic first, okay? What's the philosophy of the cynic? So basically, we check with Mr. Webster, and Mr. Webster agrees with us on our definition of cynic and basically pessimism. Okay, so now we have to get to work on the definition. Our problem with defining a cynic is because we don't know what selfish is. There are two types of selfish. There's one selfish where I only think of myself and I can't do for anybody else unless it's a gain for myself, right? Unless there's some benefit for me. Now, the thing is that when you do a noble deed, most people, when they do a noble deed, it's also selfish, because the selfishness is that they feel noble. You understand? Or they feel, they derive some benefit that they feel good about themselves by being noble. So the question is, even though some people are jumping in here around here, trying to say that I'm totally off, so just let's wait a second, let's see what happens. Some people want to say that selfishness is at the expense of others, where, in other words, if you're not hurting anybody, then it's not selfish. But if you don't think of other people when you do something, and you don't care about what other people are hurt, that is selfishness. Okay? The thing is that we run into a dead end with selfishness, because selfishness we always look at it like even everyday life. Whatever I do, even if I'm nice to a person, I do it for what my motive is. If we could avoid motive, which really has to do with the psychological thing, what motivates you, and we only want to get the act, then we will look at it from what is objectively good in any given situation. Okay? In other words, like this. Is it objectively good to help an old lady cross the street that she can't help herself? Is it objectively a good that you should do it for her?
No.
No? So what we want to say is that where it's objectively good, whatever the motive is, that is not selfish. Where it is, where a person refuses to do that which is correct in any given situation in regard to others, that is selfishness. In other words, if it only regards the person himself, like let's say smoking, right? So then there is selfishness in a stupid way, that I smoke, so I harm myself. Then there's selfishness in an intelligent way, so I give up smoking, or I don't smoke, so then that's a selfishness in an intelligent way. But insofar as the way selfishness is used, it means that in an objective way, where I should help another person and I don't, that is selfishness, and that is selfishness, okay? A cynic will say the reason why you help the old lady across the street is only to get some money out of her or to get some practical benefit in this world. That's the way he looks at people, that their motive is never for the justice itself, for the act itself, but a practical thing that he could get something out of it. There's something practical. If you go into the motivation, then we can't operate here. I mean, then we're going to really run into real complications. But however, once you stick to the act and what is objective, so then the cynic looks at the person that does a good act and says he's really a con artist and he's only really out there to con the old lady. You see? That's the way the cynic looks at life.
Oh, wow. Here's the quote from Oscar Wilde. A cynic is someone who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing.
Now that we have the facts of the cynic, namely, that he only if there's something practical, then that's the cynic. He looks at everything that a person doesn't do an act just for the act itself. We're not talking about motive.
No.
Okay, just for the act itself. There must be something practical that he gets out of it. That's how the cynic looks at life. Now, based on that, now that we have the fact of the cynic, now we can define what's the philosophy of the cynic.
The cynic's philosophy, then, is that every human action is motivated by a personal practical benefit.
They would change the term practical for tangible. We leave it to the listener to decide. The question is, what is the benefit of knowing this idea? Okay, so we know the definition of a cynic. The question is, what's the benefit of the idea? Somehow people feel we should go on more somehow to define their motive or something else. The answer is no. The reason why we are defining just the act is just to clarify, to show, in other words, there's two ways of seeing an incorrect life. What's incorrect about life, either contradiction or to define their philosophy where you see how foolish it is. You see, the only question that you might want to ask, what is the right way of life? Well, of course, I mean, in this case, I think it's obvious. The right way is, no, there are motives that are good, that are just.